Committee will please come to order. We don't have a quorum yet, but I think we can begin work on the first bill, which is House File 662, Representative Lane. So this bill, when we move it, we'll be moving it to go to the Committee on the Judiciary. So welcome to the committee, Representative Lane, and if you would, go ahead and begin presenting your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is the Department of Health's technical bill with some changes that Matthew Colley here will explain. I did want to spend a little time on radon, and we do, when we do get a quorum, need to pass two amendments along with it. But I'll just start in on some comments on the radon issue, because that's the one that leads the bill, and that's the one that's getting all the attention. And it should, because we need to know more about radon. There was an article in the newspaper not too long ago where a woman had her husband died of lung cancer, even though he had never smoked a day in his life. They discovered that the home was had very high levels of radon concentration that they lived in for 30-plus years, and it was very likely the cause of his death. It's totally an invisible, unknown thing, and we need to have more public awareness around it. So that's what this bill does. It takes this and puts it up front in the real estate transactions that when you buy or sell a house, you need to have a little disclosure around radon. Right? What stands in the disclosure right now is that basically, do you know about any radon environmental concerns? Yes or no. And if you want to check no, you just never do the test. So we want it to be a little bit more informative than that and make people very aware, because this is extremely serious. It's the second leading cause of lung cancer, and if you take out smoking, it is the leading cause beyond smoking of lung cancer. So it's an invisible thing that people don't know about, and yet it has this high problem associated with it, and we need to have a disclosure form that requires the seller and buyer to exchange this information, where the seller can say that they don't have any knowledge of concentration of radon in the dwelling, or they can then they also have to say whether a test has actually been conducted. And if they have the test and they don't know where the report is, they can check that box, but at least the person knows. Or they can go further and say, yes, here's the report of the concentration of radon. And yes, it is above the level that is EPA action level. And yes, we have mitigated it, and here's the system that does it, and here is the information that goes with that system so that you can maintain it. Now, if I were buying a house, that's what I would want. So
Representative Lane, let me just interrupt you for a second, because we do have a quorum now.
Okay.
So first of all, I know Representative Grunhagen had a motion to approve the minutes.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the minutes.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Grunhagen moves the minutes of March 5th. Any comment on the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye. All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. And then I will move House File 662, that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. And okay. Then you have some amendments, Representative Lane.
We have Amendment A1, which is amendment from the Department of Health, to just clarify a few things in their bill.
Okay. So normally we allow the author to put on amendments to get the bill in the shape in which they'd like to discuss it. So I'll move the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. And then, Representative Lane, is the other amendment
the
yours as well?
A2-1.
Okay, so we'll do the same with the A2-1.
And we have one small change, if we can add an oral. Down on line 3.29, it says licensed athletic trainers, and that's a mistake. It needs to be registered athletic trainers. They are not licensed.
Okay, did everybody get that? I'm going to incorporate this change to the amendment on line 3.29.
Madam.
Strike the word licensed and insert the word registered. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author. Just because I think some of us have heard about some controversy related to athletic training and trainers, could we just get a little background if this is just a clarifying amendment or if this is actually a new topic that we should understand?
Okay, well, Representative Loeffler, I think what we want to do is This is an author's amendment just to, I think, Representative Lane, tell me if I'm correct, just to get the bill in the shape in which you want to discuss it. And
yes, and there is someone here that could speak to that more clearly if you, when you're ready.
Well, why don't we just, I guess what I would say is let's adopt the amendment and then we can discuss various parts of it and see whether, and we don't have a 24-hour rule here, Representative Loeffler, so if something seems to you to be out of sync once we do that, we certainly entertain an amendment to strike language if need be.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just am used to people explaining the amendments.
Okay, but these are author's amendments, so we're just trying to get the bill in the shape in which the author wants it before we go forward. So the A2-1 amendment, I'm going to move that as with the incorporated change, which I hope everybody got. All those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. So, Representative Lane, then, if you would, and I hope you will be explaining the part that we just put on for Representative Loeffler, but why don't you just go ahead with your presentation.
Okay, I just wanted to make those comments about radon, and then I will pass it to Matthew Colley to discuss the bill in general.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matthew Colley, and I'm the Legislative Policy Director for the Minnesota Department of Health. I would figure I'd just go through the bill section by section. Some of them are clumped together, so if you hear me comment about multiple sections in a row, I'll try to keep a roadmap going so everyone understands what's going on here. Sort of defer to Representative Lane's comments about the first section, the Radon Awareness Act. Just to remind everyone, this is just an awareness piece. At the time of closing, information would be provided, and the checkoff sheet that should be in the packet that you have regarding the Radon Act would be something that both the seller and the buyer would have to go over. It would not mandate any testing or mitigation, just awareness about the issue as a whole. Moving on to the next section, sections 2 through 4, and this also is sections 12 through 14, have to do with TB control standards within health facilities that the Department of Health license. As it currently stands in statute, it dictates that these facilities have to follow certain standards to control TB. But back in 2005, the CDC actually updated those into better practices than what are currently in there. And for the last few years, the department has been telling our licensed facilities to follow those best practices and administratively telling them to ignore what's currently written in statute. So what we want to go in is correct the statute so that now and into the future, they're only following what is best practices as put out by the CDC. So that is sections 2 through 4 and 12 through 14. Sections 5 through 11 of the bill have to do with the adverse health events reporting that is done to the department. This is for all hospitals and outpatient surgical centers in the state. And they have to report to us one whenever one of 28 events occur. These are the sorts of things that we don't ever want to have happen. Well, we base this off of a national organization called the National Quality Forum that back in 2011 amended and updated the recommendations for what those adverse events should be. So what we're doing with this language in sections 5 through 11 is adopting those changes. We have piloted this with the Hospital Association, and we're adding a few, combining a few, and removing one that has never been reported in the state of Minnesota. So that is the adverse health events section. If we move down to section 15, this is regarding the Universal Consumer Information Guide. In those areas where we have housing with services that we license at the department, Consumer Information Guide comes into play. The idea behind it is that if someone is going to a housing with service, they should be given a brochure or a pamphlet or some sort of documentation that tells them of alternatives that offer the same sort of services. Well, falling into the housing with services statute is homeless shelters. And homeless shelters providing alternative options really isn't part of the services that homeless shelters provide. So the department has been telling homeless shelters to administratively not follow this provision, and we'd like to remove it, and that's what this section does. If we move to section 16, We have the Poison Control Center within the state. The Department of Health puts out a grant to create a Poison Control Center, which is currently held by HCMC. That grant, we have to put out an RFP every 2 years. Well, the department has found that over the last three grant cycles, HCMC has been the only applicant in that RFP process. And though when the statute was originally created, a two-year RFP process was the standard procedure, since then, state statute has been updated to reflect that most grants are allowable on a five-year process. So because this is a very stable grant funding, and because state statute allows us that opportunity, we'd like to change it so that provided our grantee continues to comply at a high level as they are, we would put out an RFP every 5 years, which would save administrative burden for both them as well as the department. Sections 17 and 18 surround the Minnesota Responds Medical Reserve Corps. This is a group of individuals that self-select themselves to be on a volunteer list to be deployed either by the Commissioner of Health or local boards of health in the event of emergencies within the state. So we're talking floods, tornadoes, public health outbreaks. And we have found that in statute, it currently states that when these people are deployed in an actual emergency, either by the department or by local boards, they have liability coverage. However, statute is a little unclear as to whether when we are actually practicing for those events and preparing for them, if that liability coverage actually applies. So the department wants to go in and clarify that whether or not they're deployed in an actual emergency or merely practicing for those emergencies, that they have liability coverage. Section 19 also surrounds the volunteer corps. We at the department have a couple of teams, the behavioral health team as well as the medical team, that the department itself deploys. And these individuals are quite often supervising others or providing services, in particular around the behavioral health team, to vulnerable adults and children. In these types of emergencies, there's quite often scenarios in which a vulnerable adult or a vulnerable child may need personal physical treatment or mental health treatment. And so the volunteers that we are deploying typically are always under supervision of someone else. But in these particular instances, they may be operating on their own. So the department would like the ability to do background checks on these individuals to ensure that when these individuals are working on their own, that we have the utmost trust in their ability to provide that care. Sections 20 and 21 are technical language surrounding occupational therapy practitioners and their use of physical agent modalities. Physical agent modalities is just a really complex word to talk about things such as providing heat treatment, ice packs, electroshock therapy for the treatment of physical ailments such as arthritis or others. The language has always stated that a requirement of being able to do a physical agent modality is you have to seek approval through the Department of Health. But the statute isn't very clearly written in that regard, and we quite often get questions about what the requirements are. So this language would be to go in and try to make that clear so that the providers know exactly what they are currently required to do and what they will continue to be required to do. Section 22 surrounds a process we call field-delivered therapy. So field-delivered therapy is our attempt to try and prevent the continued spread of sexually transmitted diseases, such as chlamydia and gonorrhea. We have a team within the department that tries to find individuals who have been diagnosed with these diseases, but have, for whatever reason, not followed up on actually getting this treated. Typically, these are underinsured or the uninsured population within the state. One of the models that the CDC has promoted to try and control this is field-delivered therapy, which is the providing of a single-dose antibiotic to the individual to clear up their condition. We are going to continue, as we always have, to try and get them to see their doctor to clear these up, to follow up with their prescriptions. But if that is unable to do so, we would offer to come out and provide them with that single-dose antibiotic for them. And then lastly, there's a section of repealers, which have been modified by the amendment. So I would move to the A1, sort of explain what's in the amendment that adds to the bill. The first section of the amendment is surrounding our loan forgiveness program. If we're looking on the second page, it's particularly in lines 2.1. So our loan forgiveness program provides loan forgiveness to medical health professionals in the state, and we require them to serve in underserved areas for usually a minimum of 3 years. We want to ensure that they stay within those areas for that time. And what is currently is required is an affidavit, which is a very specialized technical way of them confirming to us that they are so where they are. It can be burdensome to those individuals who are receiving that loan forgiveness. So what we're changing is to a confirmation, which basically means they have to provide us something not quite as technical as an affidavit, but still something that verifies that they are practicing where they say they are and fulfilling the requirements that we have them under. Lines 2.9 and 2.10 are merely a technical addition. We correcting some language surrounding the occupational therapy practitioners that I mentioned earlier. And then Section 23 removes the two repealers that are currently in the bill. One of them was a mistaken addition that's actually in a different department bill that we'll be bringing forward from this committee later. And the other one surrounds the TB standards. It's more efficient for us to do it through where what we're repealing is obsolete rules, and it's more efficient for us to do that per advisor instruction through a different process. The repealer that you see in there we're actually putting in also surrounds the loan forgiveness program. The federal government provided us some grants a little over a decade ago to provide loan forgiveness. Their requirements have since changed, so we are removing the obsolete language in statute. Nothing about the program actually changes in that regard. We're just merely removing the language you don't need anymore. Madam Chair, that's my overview of the bill. It was probably more technical than everyone needed, but hopefully it provided what was necessary, and I will be able to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Colley. And I don't know that you addressed Representative Loeffler's question, which was on the A2-1, and I assume that that was from the department as well?
The A2-1 is not from the department. Oh. My understanding is that it's technical language, so there is no objection from the department. But I would ask someone else to come up to speak on that.
Representative Lane, was that?
Yes. There was someone that's going to come down?
I'm sorry, Representative Lane, I had understood that that was an author's amendment. It was it not?
Yeah, well, yes, it came through me. Is that
okay?
Go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brent Milliken, and I'm with the Minnesota Athletic Trainers Association. And the amendments that are the bill language that we have brought about are the technical language changes that are non-controversial that have been approved by both the PTs and the OTs to move forward to clean up our practice act.
Any questions on that, members? Okay, I guess I have a question on that because I know there has been a lot of controversy around this, and I'd like you to kind of walk through it if you would.
Okay, yes, I can do that. Just. Yeah, I'm ready.
Please, go ahead. Just if you would walk through.
I'll just walk through all the changes. Okay, okay, absolutely. Well, in sections 1.4 through 1.12, these are just the changes to change our accrediting agencies. That accrediting agency had changed, and we put it more generalized terms. And so that way, for future, if that agency changes again, it's set, and we don't have to readdress it at a later time. Same thing through sections 114 through 116. That was the same rationale on that as well. In regards to section 1.23, that was just to add the AT as wording to identify athletic trainers and to put title protection to that aspect. In section 2.3, the athletic training student has been changed to be in same consistency with national our national association as well as our education accreditation program. And so that's just nomenclature they use, and we felt it could be consistent with that. In section 2.11, except for the initial appointees, this bill went into effect in 1993, so essentially the initial appointees, that language is no longer needed. In section 2.28, currently an athlete trainer must have completed a degree from a four-year school. However, there are entry-level master's programs out there, and so we also wanted to include that degree as well and recognize that. In regards to 3.2, the idea was that you don't need to have that within 1 year of the application for the registration, because there's an opportunity to take the test more frequently now than what it used to be. And so we didn't feel we needed to keep that language in there, that the frequency needs to occur more. They have options more frequent. Section 3.12. Temporary registration had typically been for 1 year, and we changed it to 120 days for the same rationale. They have options to take that test certification exam more frequently, and so we felt we should tighten up that time frame. And that same applies for 3.14 and 3.15. It's just housekeeping there. In 3.20 and 3.21, we decided to change it from, this is more of tightening the what's allowed. It used to be an athlete trainer could supervise four temporary registered athlete trainers, and we have now shortened that up to two, again, consistent with the ability for them to take the test more frequently. 3.26 is, again, consistent with language change, just so if there's changes in those, that it's continued to be reflective. 3.29 and 3.30, and this also includes the amendment that was, I do believe, was approved to change from licensed to registered. We cited, as opposed to us having our own disciplinary processes and language, that we felt it was important to have this here that's consistent with the Board of Medical Practices disciplinary processes, and which is also what they apply with other healthcare professions. And then the last section, that 4.2, 4.3, that's the same rationale as we talked about at the beginning of the bill. So, are there any questions regarding those?
I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
Brent Milliken.
Mr. Milliken, did you tell us what the repealer is here on line 4.6?
The repealers are consistent with the old disciplinary language and the registration by equivalency, which then no longer exists. You have to go through an approved accredited program now.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason why I called this out was because those of us who've been around before can have often gotten burned when licensing issues come up and a small group thinks there's peace and harmony in the valley and they haven't talked to all the people on the hillsides or even all the people in the valley. And I'm really have some reluctance about putting what I think is a major change in licensing for any occupation as an amendment. I mean, we've adopted it, but I really think it should have been introduced as a separate bill on what is really a technical corrections bill from a state agency, since it isn't a state agency recommendation. And, you know, we go from six accrediting agencies to a single one that's selected by the board. I don't know what implications that has for having schools in or out or people who went through the older school in or out. It may mean nothing. You know this stuff better than we do, but it might. It has a change in discipline policy to the Board of Medical Examiner's standards. I don't know if that's a much tougher standard or an easier standard or if it's comparable to others who practice in similar allied professionals, aid groups. And so, you know, it's very hard for me to feel comfortable with this. And I'm not disparaging you and the work of whoever you worked with, but I didn't hear that you have adopted this through a public process, that you reached out to everybody who is, impacted. And so I have some concerns about this, I will just say. And, you know, I would hope that we as a committee would think about that in terms of whether this is the right vehicle. Because I would like to hear some testimony from others who might be impacted to say it really is as uncontroversial as they present it. But just having gone through licensing wars in the past, I'm a little hesitant about doing such a big amendment that on a technical bill. And we've adopted it because it was an author's amendment, but I do just want to put it on the record. So if I hear from others later, I can say, well, I did raise some concerns.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Lane.
I would commit to checking this out more thoroughly before it reaches the next committee.
Thank you.
Representative Lane, there are a couple other members have questions. I'm equally uncomfortable with this. I appreciate it. I kind of shut Representative Loeffler off before when she raised this because I thought this was just an author's amendment coming from the department, and it's not. It's something that really goes afield from where I thought this bill was going, and I also am uncomfortable with it, but I'm going to call on Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I would move to strike the amendment.
Okay, Representative Albright moves to strike the amendment. Is there, Representative Grunhagen is also on the list. Did you want to speak to the amendment, Representative Grunhagen?
I just wanted to announce publicly that I completely agree with Representative Loeffler's assessment.
Uh-oh. All right. Well, I think that we're going to vote on the amendment, and I think that, of course, doesn't preclude bringing these issues up again, but I apologize, members. I thought this was just an additional technical amendment. I was not aware of this. Representative Lane.
Who's saying that? For you?
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Franson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. There are some people in the crowd, though, that did travel to hear this amendment. And so I know at least one gentleman drove over 2 hours to be here today.
Well, on this amendment, Representative Franson?
No,
I think, well,
was this one
Well, Representative Franson, if there's someone who's here, is there someone in the audience? Please raise your hand if you're here to testify on this amendment.
Madam Chair, but we're still on the motion.
Yes, so we are on the motion.
To make everyone aware of where
absolutely,
we're at. So,
Representative
absolutely.
Albright. Yes, we're on a motion to strike this amendment. Is there someone here who came a long way to testify on this amendment or who wants to testify on it? Okay. So, Representative Abler.
Well, first I just have a technical question. What is the motion to strike? We can just vote no on it. I don't know if that's a motion.
No, Representative Abler, you came in late. We had adopted this. I thought it was an author's amendment, just a technical, and it takes us into a whole other area. So
I'll go back to my. Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry I was late.
All right.
Yeah, I got it.
Is there any other discussion?
But Madam Chair, to the motion, at least to the content, and if the committee is uncomfortable, I'm not part of any of this, putting this amendment together. I do understand the process of getting things done that are not controversial. The bill does discuss occupational therapists, which is in a related capacity. The amendment is without controversy. As I understand the merit of it, and in committee, the committee can act upon anything in its jurisdiction and load up bills how they like, and because the germaneness rules are much more lax in committee, and so I think if you're going to not do it, you should do it for merit as opposed to just the fact of the process. So at least I'm speaking against striking it, and we urge members to reconsider that you would get rid of this just because you didn't like the fact it's not in the base bill of the Department of Health.
Well, Representative Abler, I'm not saying it isn't germane. I'm just saying we adopted this thinking it was an author's amendment. We should have had a complete discussion before adopting it. We didn't have that. And I think that we're going to vote on the amendment unless there's more discussion on it, or on the motion to strike the amendment.
And just as an elaboration, Madam Chair, I'm looking in statute, and it literally changes 7 or 8 pages of statute. This is not a technical correction. This entirely revises the way that athletic trainers are disciplined, how they are credentialed, how they are assigned and made eligible for credentialing. This is more than just changing ifs and thans.
Okay, Madam Chair, Representative Abler.
I'll yield to whoever was talking. I'll go after them. Didn't somebody else want to?
You're speaking, Representative Abler.
Oh, okay. But there's somebody else said, Madam Chair, and that wasn't me.
Okay.
But anyway, so, here's an amendment before us. And so I wasn't here for the vote that went on, and you're correct, it probably should have been discussed before. And so now we're having a discussion about if we should have kept it or not, and if it stays in or stays out. But so maybe if you want to ask if anybody in the audience is interested in testifying against it, that'd give us a clue about the controversy of it. But the athletic trainers are a small group. They don't have a great deal of money. They are just a white hat bunch. And they bring forward, they have some controversy at some of their topics with the therapists. Not in this little niche. This has nothing to do with the controversy about their scope. And it's kind of housekeeping. And sometimes it's important for time reasons to get these things accomplished, and that's why they bring bills. So just to the members, and maybe, Madam Chair, if you want to ask if anybody has any objections, that would be a question you could choose to ask. But I would still urge people to vote against striking it and keeping it in, and the author can work on it if there's any controversy coming forward.
So the motion before us, Representative Albright, if you'll allow me to kind of fix it a little bit, the motion is to reconsider the amendment. Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Abler's point, I would just say asking for testimony at this point is inappropriate because anyone who might be negatively impacted or have concerns had no public notice because it wasn't introduced as a bill, and it's being asked to be tagged onto a bill that's being described as, mostly non-controversial updating of Department of Health statutes. And so if an educational institution would find problems with this, if someone, I just think it needs to have that kind of public notice.
Okay, so the motion is to reconsider the amendment. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no.
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 The motion prevails. We are reconsidering the amendment, and I'm going to withdraw it.
Okay.
So thank you, members.
Madam Chair, I just will apologize for my lack of awareness as to how this process actually worked. I just assumed when the department approved it that it was fine. I didn't know about these controversies that had pre-existed.
That's okay. All right. So we have some public testifiers on the bill. And I have next Dr. Steck from St. John's. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Oh, and excuse me, before you start speaking, Representative Mack, did you have a question right now? Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you for this opportunity to speak in support of the radon awareness provisions of HF662. My name is Dan Steck. I'm a nuclear physicist who had the fortune to have a day job as a university physics professor. This job allowed me the freedom to research the effects of radiation exposure in Minnesota homes. Research started in 1983 when my wife and I were building our home in Collegeville. I discovered that our home had radon concentrations much higher than the national average home, and that my neighbors had even higher radon than we did. As the maps that are attached to my testimony that I hope you have a copy of show, I've measured radon in thousands of homes across the state. Places like Oslo and Moose Lake and North Mankato and Fairmont. I found that the typical house in Minnesota has about three times the radon concentration as the typical house across the U.S. and that elevated indoor radon concentrations are common all over Minnesota. Scientific studies during the last 20 years have established that long-term residential radon exposure at concentrations like we have in our home are a significant cause of lung cancer. Public health and radiation protection organizations like the World Health Organization, the US EPA, the Surgeon General recommend that we take action to reduce our exposure to radon concentrations like we have in our home. There are some pieces of good news. First, it's fairly easy to reduce radon in most homes. In an independent study, I found that the Minnesota mitigation contractors routinely can get homes, the radon in homes, reduced to levels near outdoor concentrations. And this kind of reduction eliminates most of the lung cancer risk in those homes. Second, mitigating houses would save many lives and a lot of money in the long run, a lot of money. Unfortunately, a few people survive lung cancer for more than a year once it's diagnosed. It turns out to be more effective to prolong lives and much more cost-effective to extend a life by preventing the lung cancer rather than trying to treat it once it develops. This year, approximately 700 Minnesotans will die of lung cancer due to radon exposure. Compare that to 50 from fires, 10 from carbon monoxide. It's a huge number. Those victims will lose approximately 16 more years of life simply because they lived in unmitigated homes. It's time to take meaningful action and encourage all Minnesotans to mitigate high radon homes, and the radon provision, radon awareness provisions of HF662 are a promising first step to try to get people to take more action. I urge adoption of the Radon Awareness Act. Madam Chair, thank you for this time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Are there questions, members? Representative Mack had a question first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if Representative Lane or the testifier or someone from the department, but on this, don't we currently have laws or regulations around radon issues and reporting issues, or is there essentially nothing in statute right now?
As far as I know, there's essentially nothing.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe that in the sale of real estate, there is simply a list of environmental hazards, and radon is one of them, which you simply check out whether you have any awareness of any hazard of radon in your home.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just remember my husband and I were recently looking for a home and had radon tests done, and I guess I couldn't remember if we just did that upon the recommendation of our real estate agent and he just was nice enough to suggest that, or if we were forced to do that. I couldn't remember, so just wanted to ask. So thank you.
Okay. Other questions, members? Representative Johnson.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Doctor, you mentioned that it's relatively easy to mitigate for radon in a home. Can you briefly describe how it's done?
Dr. Steck.
Madam Chair, The most effective and most common way of reducing the radon in the home is to ventilate the soil underneath the house. Typically, this involves making a 5-gallon bucket worth size hole underneath the slab and connecting that hole with tubing that runs through the house, either in the house or outside the house, and a fan draws on that tubing and exhausts the gas outside. I have such a system in my house. Works very well.
Madam Chair, I would just say that someone told me that it costs from $800 to $2,500 with an average of $1,500 to do this.
Okay. And we have another testifier, thank you very much, who on this topic, I think, Paul Egger. Welcome to the committee, and I would just ask you to please be brief.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Egger. I'm the Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And just to briefly respond to Representative Mack's question or comment about disclosure, Minnesota does have a material fact disclosure statute. It's found in Chapter 513, which this committee doesn't spend a lot of time on, but I won't go into the details. But essentially, that requires all sellers of real property in Minnesota to disclose any facts that may affect the use or enjoyment of the property by the seller. So, Representative Mack, when you were looking at homes, there isn't a laundry list of different items to disclose. It's up to the seller to identify those material facts of which they're aware that would impact your use and enjoyment. And to the other aspect of that, Representative Lane referenced the checking off of radon. And what she's referring to is that one of the services that we provide our members is we produce the forms that you will see in a real estate transaction. And one of those forms is the seller disclosure statement. And because radon, you know, comes up often, questions from buyers about radon in the home, there is a checkoff box to prompt the seller to disclose if that's an issue of which they're aware that there's a problem. You know, we certainly don't oppose disclosure. It's an important aspect of the transaction. Our members work with both buyers and sellers. We're happy to continue to work with the Department of Health. We've had one conversation right after the bill was introduced. We're trying to just make sure we're on the same page, Madam Chair and committee. And to that point, Mr. Colley, who was here earlier from the department, will be meeting tomorrow along with the Senate author to just kind of go over the language and see if this is the most informative, concise, simple way to communicate the information. And you know, we're committed to working through kind of the language and make sure we're on the same page.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Egger. Appreciate that very much. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. More of a comment. I was selling real estate in the early days when radon became something that people were aware of, and corporate relocation was fairly common, and they required a radon test before someone could proceed with the house, and at least to be informed. And I totally support this disclosure, but it really is, the seller has to say, if you know about it, then you need to disclose it. You don't have to go and seek it out and try to find things.
Okay, thank you. And I've been informed this bill will go to Commerce as well as Judiciary, so there'll be more opportunities to look at this as well. Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, Mr. Eder. How often do you think the seller discloses radon out of all the transactions?
Mr. Eger.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I do not know. I can check around and see if we have any kind of information on that, but I don't know.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've just not heard of it happening, so it doesn't.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Karen Sames.
Hey.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. My name is Karen Sames, and I am happy to speak on behalf of the membership of the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association. We support the change proposed by the Department of Health. In our own practice, we use the term occupational therapy practitioner to refer to the two levels of occupational therapy practitioners that there are, the occupational therapy assistant and the occupational therapist. And so we agree with the definition that's proposed. Last summer, we became aware that there were occupational therapy assistants and the occupational therapists that supervise them during physical agent modalities. And again, those are heat, cold, ultrasound, and electrical stimulation. And the language in the current licensure statutes simply say occupational therapist. We think changing that to occupational therapy practitioner will clarify things, and so we urge the committee to approve that change.
All right, thank you. Are there questions for members? All right, not seeing any. So are there other testifiers for or against this bill? Okay, so Representative Womer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question on several of the sections here, Section 12, 13, and 14, all address tuberculosis. This isn't about occupational therapists, though. So I don't know, Representative...
Mr. Colley back.
Yeah, Mr. Colley or Representative Lane. Could you just help me understand these sections and why they're there? Are there a lot of incidences of tuberculosis? Or what's going on there? Thanks.
Mr. Colley.
Certainly, Madam Chair, and Representative Lohmer. Again, my name is Matthew Colley. I'm with the Department of Health. Yes, these are. It's a technical change regarding tuberculosis control. Any licensed facility has to follow guidelines to control the spread of tuberculosis if it were to break out. And so, what this is merely doing is saying that because the CDC has updated their best practices, how to best do this. We want to make sure that the statute reflects that, and so there's any confusion over what is the best practice and what our licensed facility should be doing to keep this from getting out of control.
Representative Lohmer? Okay. Okay, I have Representative Franson and then Mac. Representative Franson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I'm just wondering if this is an unfunded mandate. Is there a cost change at all?
Mr. Colley.
Madam Chair and Representative Franzen, no, this is, as I mentioned earlier, they are following this now, and they have been for a couple of years because we've been telling them administratively to do this sort of thing. So this is merely making statute catch up with what we're already doing.
Representative Mack?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a brief question on the adverse event reports. I think you said we currently report 25 or 24, or we're adding one. Well, I'm wondering what the new one is that we're adding that we never have before. I take it this is according to CDC guidelines and what they recommend or where that's coming from.
Mr. Colley.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, we're actually adding four events, but we're consolidating two and removing one, so in the end, we're only adding one in terms of straight numbers. But the if you look on the fact sheet, adverse health events update in the second column under key features, it lists the four new events, and then on the back page, it mentions which ones we're consolidating and removing.
Okay, and Madam Chair,
Representative Mack,
those four, I see that there's a list. A few listed here under subdivision 2. Are those the new ones? I have to line it up with the document you just referenced and pull that out. Do those align or not necessarily?
Mr. Colley.
I think I'm understanding your question to be, Representative Mack, does the ones that we're talking about adding, do they align with what's currently in the bill?
Yeah.
Yes. I don't know if they line up with number by number, but we can check with you. Okay.
All right. Thank you. So I think we're ready to vote on the bill, members. So I will renew my motion that House File 662 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you,
Thank
Representative
you,
Lane. The next bill on the agenda is House File 767. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair,
I would like to move House File 767, recommend it to pass and be referred to the Committee on the Judiciary.
All right. Representative Morgan moves that House File 767 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. And then I understand that you have an author's amendment, Representative Morgan.
I do, Madam Chair, and this is a real author's amendment, and it will be reflected in the narrative when DHS goes through the bill for us. So I would move the A1 author's amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Morgan moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the order in which he would like to have it discussed. All in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. The motion prevails. We've adopted the A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, I have another amendment, and I know there are two others that I believe Representative Abler might have. But I'd like to hold off on the A3 amendment and those others until after we hear the bill, if that's okay with you.
Please.
Okay. Then, Madam Chair, House File 767 is a Department of Human Services bill. There are a few policy changes in the continuing care area. And covering long-term care policy. There are some technical changes, some policy modifications, and there are three staff here from the department to testify. We'll start off with Heidi Hamilton, who will begin the testimony.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Heidi Hamilton. I'm with the Disability Services Division at the Department of Human Services. I will walk through the sections of the bill related to disability services, then we'll turn it over to my colleagues to present the other sections of the bill. I'll speak to the language in the bill and address any changes included in the author's amendment. Section 1 of the bill adds an exemption to the number of task forces that a state agency can create when a task force is mandated by court order. Without this exception, the current language limits the commissioner to 4 task forces where members can have expenses reimbursed. An example of when this exception may be used is the recent Jessen settlement, which required the formation of the Rule 40 Advisory Committee and also the Olmstead Planning Committee. Both have very heavy participation of community members that would require reimbursement to participate. So this means that 2 of the 4 committees that the commissioner was allowed were related to a single settlement agreement. Section 4 of the bill eliminates the requirement for the department to send mailings to medical assistants for employed persons with disabilities enrollees who are turning age 63 or 64. Last session, the upper age limit of 65 for MAEPD enrollees was eliminated, so these letters are no longer necessary.
And could I just have you pause there? Where are you? What section are you
on? I'm sorry, I'm in section 4 now. I'm moving around a little bit because I'm just doing the sections related to disability services, and then other people will do the other sections.
Okay, so we have a summary from House Research, and so you're on section 4 of that, or on what page in the, what page, 14? Page 14 of the bill? That's fine. It's fine if you want to skip around, but it would be helpful, I think, to members to know where we are.
Okay.
Please proceed.
Okay. Section 5. Corrects an outdated rule reference for authorization of private duty nursing services. Sections 6 and 7 are removed by the A1 amendment, so I won't address those. Sections 10 and 14 relate to the implementation of the MnChoices assessment tool. The changes include requiring assessments and reassessments under the developmental disabilities waiver to be conducted by a certified assessor using the long-term care consultation process, which brings it in line with other programs covered by the MnChoices comprehensive assessment. Section 9 is also removed by the A1 amendment. Sections 8 corrects the placement of language that passed during the 2012 session regarding input of providers into the assessment process. We just are moving the language from the statute governing the program to the statute that governs the assessment process. Now I'll move to Section 15. This adds child foster care to the definition of settings where home and community-based services may be provided. This language passed last session and inadvertently left out child foster care from the list of settings. On the A1 amendment, it also related to medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, removes the language that relates to eligibility for individuals turning 65 in 2012 or 2013. This language is effective January 1st, 2014, when it will no longer be necessary, this elimination of this language. Those are the sections related to disability services, so I'll stand for any questions on those sections.
Okay, so members, questions on the disability services part of the bill. And I hope you'll stick around to the end in case any questions come up. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm not seeing any, so okay. Thank you very much. Mana Yasiri, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Muna Yasiri, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. I'm going to address the sections of House File 767 that are specifically related to nursing facility issues. Beginning with Section 2, the changes that you'll find in Section 2 have been added primarily just as clarifying language to add an effective date to the section, which was enacted in 2011. Section 3 relates to what we refer to the nursing home and board and care home resident relocation portion. This affects nursing facility residents that are in facilities that are undergoing a partial or complete facility closure. The changes that have been made to this portion of the statute, which was enacted a little over 10 years ago, are the culmination of about a year's work, a collaborative effort by a statewide work group. This work group consisted of representatives from the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care, nursing facilities, as well as both provider organizations representing nursing facilities, the Department of Human Services, the Minnesota Department of Health, and several county representatives as well. The changes to Section 3 fall primarily into three categories: changes and enhancements to policy areas and clarification edits, both of which are the result of over 10 years of experience that we have with the resident relocation statute and the processes therein. The last type of changes were incorporated to resolve conflicts between our state statute and federal law, which had some changes that were made late in 2012. So it's to bring our statute into compliance with this federal law changes. In Section 3, there are three significant changes that have been made to that section, significant meaning things that are not process-oriented or clarification edits. The first being an enhanced role of coordination and communication with managed care organizations, especially since many of them are serving larger numbers of seniors in facilities than they have in the past. The second major change to this section is a prohibition on the admission of new residents to a nursing facility once the 60-day required notice, public notice of closure has been provided. And the third change is greater personal liability for the nursing home administrator for failure to provide this public notice and adhere to any other parts of the statutory regulations. Both the latter two changes, the prohibition on admission of residents after the 60-day public notice and the greater liability for nursing home administrators, are as a result, direct result of the federal changes that have already gone through and have been enacted in 2012. Sections 11 and Section 12 as well reduce burdens on nursing facility providers by creating administrative simplification. Right now, approximately 80% of nursing facilities are currently requesting an extension to file their statistical and cost reports. This language will simply effectively remove the extension provision and push the time back, the due date back for all nursing facilities, thereby eliminating the need for any extension requests on the part of nursing facilities. Sorry, I'm losing my track here.
I'm sorry, I lost my tracker. I lost the part that this is falls under. I believe it's section 14 refers to an erroneous cross-reference. This is line 26.31, refers to an erroneous cross-reference in the statute, and it's merely a correction of the subdivision and paragraph that it refers to. And finally, section 17 is a repealer of language that also goes hand-in-hand with the changes in section 3 related to the resident relocation statutory language.
So, Ms. Yasseri, as I was following along here, I think it was section 13 that corrects the cross-reference, and then there's a section 14 that I don't think you addressed that.
Yes, I'm sorry. Section 13 is the one that actually was addressing the erroneous cross-reference. Section 14 is not a section that our area will be addressing. Okay. And then section 17 is cross-reference to section 3, again referring to the resident relocation provisions. That is the repealer of the language allocating funds for the relocation costs of the counties.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you. Members, any questions to this part of the bill? Representative Loeffler.
I suspect it's technical, but the one repealer you said is the provision dealing with allocating costs to the county or somehow dealing with county funding. Is that a technical change as well and not a policy change?
Ms. Yasseri.
Madam Chair, Representative Laughlin. The section repealing the funding allocation in Section 17, the actual funding that was provided under that provision expired in about 2006. We did receive carryover authority for several years, and it has since expired. Since 2006, the requirements of counties to provide the follow-up work related to resident relocation remains in the statute, and they have been carrying out that work without any remuneration for their efforts. So it is a technical, because there are no funds.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair, and then just a follow-up, since there's an acknowledgement that they have responsibilities without funding, do the changes in this increase those responsibilities, or do they just clarify them?
Ms. Yasseri.
Madam Chair, Representative Laughlin, the changes in this do not represent an increase in responsibilities on the part of the counties. It actually allows or affords them some flexibility in terms of how they achieve that follow-up work, how they conduct the follow-up work, and reduces their burden to a certain extent. The department has also been exploring the possibility on a federal level of some alternative funding mechanism and looking at that possibility as well.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I understand what's going on now.
Okay. Other questions, members? Okay. Looking at our nursing home guy here.
I'm good.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Please don't go away till we finish the bill. We may come up with some more questions for you. Yeah. Thank you very much. Let's see. We have Rachel Shans. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rachel Shans, and I'm with DHS Aging and Adult Services Division. And I have just two sections of the bill that I want to review with you. First, I would turn your attention to the A1 amendment. Starting on line 1.3, the addition of Section 2 to the bill. This is a purely technical amendment, correcting a cross-reference to the section of statute that outlines an individual's appeal rights related to nursing facility level of care determination. So again, this is purely technical. And then I will turn your attention to Section 16 of the bill, which is on page 29. This section of the bill is related to county adult protection units. It requires county adult protection units to use a validated structured decision-making tool in order to carry out work that's currently mandated by state law. When a county receives a report about potential maltreatment of a vulnerable adult who lives in the community, the adult protection units are responsible to investigate this report. Counties also provide necessary protective services to vulnerable adults who have been subject to maltreatment. And a vulnerable adult is a person over the age of 18 who, because of a physical or mental disability, or due to dependency on services is vulnerable to maltreatment. In 2009, six Minnesota counties collaborated with the National Council on Crime and Delinquency to develop a structured decision-making tool for use by adult protection staff. And the counties involved in this effort were Dakota, Hennepin, Olmsted, Ramsey, Steele, and Washington. Research supports the conclusion that for complex decisions, structured frameworks result in more reliable and accurate decisions than clinical judgment alone, even for highly skilled professionals. The structured decision-making tool is designed to reinforce the clinical judgment of adult protection workers along critical decision points of the assessment and investigative process. For example, after a county receives a report, the professionals must determine whether or not the adult that is the subject of the report meets the definition of a vulnerable adult. They also must determine whether the alleged action rises to the level of maltreatment, meaning abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation. So the tool guides professionals through key decision points and requires documentation of the rationale for the worker's decision. Use of the tool results in more reliable, consistent, and accurate decision-making throughout the adult protection investigative process. Counties support the use of this tool. The tool won the 2012 County Achievement Award from the Association of Minnesota Counties. The six counties that have developed the tool have been using it for several years, and the tool went statewide on a voluntary basis at the beginning of 2013. As of March 1st, 66 counties have implemented the tool on a voluntary basis. And this proposal would make the use of the tool a requirement. So I will stand for any questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions? All right. I'm not seeing any questions, so thank you very much. Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, I think at this time I'd like to go to the A3 amendment, if that's possible. The A3 amendment was offered by Senator Nenow in the Senate, and it went on the bill in the Senate. DHS has indicated that they're fine with the amendment, which inclines me to be fine with the amendment. But I think before I ask the committee to vote on the amendment, I'd like to have staff describe what the amendment would do and if there's any need for a conversation about the amendment here in the House. We, of course, shouldn't just do things because the Senate does them. So I would like it to be a conscious policy decision before we move forward, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morgan. So are you moving the A3 amendment?
I'll move the A3 amendment.
Okay. Representative Morgan moves the A3. And so staff, I don't know who it would be, Ms. Pignelli?
Madam Chair, members, my understanding is that in the original bill, sections 6 and 9 that were amended out in the A1 amendment were related to certified assessors, and what that language was doing was limiting the assessments to being done by county staff and not allowing counties to contract out for that, which I think some counties do now. What this amendment is doing is it's requiring DHS to submit a waiver request to CMS to allow counties to continue to contract out for those assessments, and this is all related to the implementation of the new MnChoices assessment tool.
Okay. Questions with that, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, thank you, Ms. Pignelli. I think that makes sense. So, if I understand right now, counties can contract out for these services, and we need to apply for a waiver in order to continue to allow, and that's what this would, that's, we're trying to continue to allow counties to contract out for this assessment process. Am I understanding that right?
Ms. Pignelli?
Madam Chair and Representative Mack, I believe with the implementation of MnChoices, we do need to explore getting a waiver in order to be able to continue to contract out.
So,
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So by us passing the A3 amendment, we would further allow ourselves to hopefully allow counties to contract out, if I'm understanding correctly.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, I believe that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mack. Ms. Pignelli, is there anyone from the department who would want to speak to this? Because this is requiring the commissioner to submit a waiver. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pam Urkel. I work for the Department of Human Services Disability Services Division, and what the amendment is doing is, that is correct. We are, with the implementation of MnChoices, we'll be changing the way the department reimburses lead agencies, counties, for doing these assessments, from a service to paying it for it as an administrative function, which is really what it is. It's determining eligibility for services and programs. And by doing that, we will be reimbursing counties via what we call the random moment time study methodology. And that's done by our agreement with the federal government through our cost allocation plan, our Medicaid administrative cost allocation plan. And the cost allocation plan currently does not allow for counties to use contracted costs in their cost reports to the department. So what the amendment is doing is asking us to rewrite our cost allocation plan and ask the CMS to allow for that to occur.
Okay. Other questions from members? Thank you for that explanation. Okay. So Representative Morgan renews the motion on the A3 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the A3 is adopted.
Thank you.
And there are two other amendments here. Is one of these yours, Representative Abler, or both?
Madam Chair, they both are. Do you have a preference of which comes first?
Those are your amendments.
Madam Chair, I'll move the A2 amendment.
Okay, Representative Abler moves the A2 amendment.
And there's a bill to this effect, but it's a tiny bill, and I think it's very germane to this topic. It would go on this bill if there was a section on PCAs. The simple situation is this, is if you're using PCA services, you can request the gender to be your own. Two years ago, a fellow came to my office, told a terrible tale about this client who was a woman who wound up being raped by her PCA. But as along the way, he would stand her up and wash her. These are not terribly capable individuals, and he just found that appalling, and we couldn't take any action because he was nervous if he told us her name and the place that she'd get retaliation. But out of that, I got the idea, at the very least, we can rescue future people from that by if they would select that they want a woman or something. So the department is neutral on this, and I talked to the author, and I hope that you can accept it.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Are there questions on the amendment?
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Morgan first.
I support the amendment.
All right, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a point of clarification, Representative Abler, as I read it, it says they can require, is it only if they can request it to be the same gender? Would this prohibit, I'm just, might take it to the extreme a little bit, but I'm thinking of a situation where, let's say, you had a person and maybe they did have some sort of a mental issue or obsession, wanted one of the opposite sex for the wrong reason. Could that also happen, or is this they can only make the request for it to be the same gender? Am I reading that correctly?
Representative Abler.
Madam Chair, and I haven't spent the time thinking about that, but line 121 says same gender, and line 2.4 says same gender. So we're just trying to get away from like unwanted rape things and all that. So.
Thanks, Representative Mack.
Thank
all right, thank you. Well, Representative Abler, I fully support your intention here. We've had a little offline conversation about whether this is legal. And we did get a little research on that, and I have to say that I was not entirely convinced by the research that we got, because it's a question of whether you can whether it's a bona fide occupational qualification to say that somebody has to be of a certain gender. I don't know if we can resolve that here today, and so with that caveat.
If you would just want to adopt it and see if they throw it out, I suppose they could always not be allowed to request. But I talked to Ms. Henry, and she said it's a problem, she thinks that they can ask now, but this would clarify that you could. I don't speak for her beyond that, but I hope we can at least address this. So.
Yeah, Representative Abler, I think in a situation where. I think the problem we run into here, if the personal care assistant is performing services like, certainly like what you were describing. If they're washing the person, if they're intimate services, I don't think there's any question that you could say that it has to be someone of the same gender or that the person should be able to request that. The only place I think there might be a question is, as I understand it, not all PCAs are doing that kind of intimate work. Like you have some that are, say, for behavioral help and things like that. And I don't know if it would be considered discriminatory to say, well, I only want a woman to do that kind of help, to give me that help, or I only want a man to give me the help. But, you know, just having expressed that concern, I think we can go ahead and vote on this. Representative Morgan has it.
Madam Chair, that's what I was going to say. I'd be happy to continue to work with Representative Abler to try and clear up any problems, but I think this is a good amendment. I think we should adopt it today.
Okay. All right. Anything else on this, members? All right. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
And Madam Chair.
And Representative Abler.
I'd like to move the A5 amendment.
Representative Abler moves the A5 amendment.
And currently there's a report on case management coming out. I don't know how much money we spend on it, but it's tens or hundreds of millions of dollars on some kind of care coordination. There's a work group, and they're going to continue working. If I had, I would have done more work on this if it were my gavel, because this was the next thing I was going to work on. But all I'm going to be able to do at this point is to encourage them to continue working and come back with some plans. There's a move where people want to hire their own case manager for service provision, and the administrative part is being separated out, which is all part of the progress and underway. I worked with the department to write down what would be helpful to them as they continue to work. There's no cost. They intended it anyway, but this gives them some timelines and some certainty that actually action will come out of the work group. Relative, and there's a bunch of issues. There's about qualification of the manager. If you hire a nonprofit, what kind of could a person do it, and are they qualified or not? Are they, and what kind of credentials should they have? What are the rates that are going to be? Who can do it? What if there's nothing available in your remote part of the state? And so, this is productive, and the department is officially neutral, but I think they like the idea of it. So, and it's meant to be friendly to them, and they frankly helped in the writing of it. So,
Representative Morgan.
Madam Chair, when Representative Abel says it, there's no cost. I trust him. I trust he knows what he's talking about here, and I support his amendment.
Okay. Any questions for members? Anybody from the department or anybody wants to testify for or against this amendment?
Madam Chair.
Representative
Abel. They're smiling and nodding, so that's a good sign. I've had the other reaction sometimes, Madam Chair. This is better.
Okay. With that, Representative Abler, we will vote on the amendment. All those in favor of the A5 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Discussion to the bill as amended. All right. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question on Section 16, which I think it's about the structured tool. Assessment tool for counties. I just wanted to make sure, you said 66 counties have adopted it, now this will make it a requirement. I'm assuming there's not much cost or any cost that counties will have to take on as a result of this mandate.
Shands.
Madam Chair and Representative Mack, there's no cost to the counties to implement the tool. They have access to the tool through a secure web-based portal at no cost to them.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Other questions, members? Okay. All right. Seeing none, Representative Morgan renews his motion that the House File 767 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment, or the bill passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate your help today.
Okay, members, we only have a few minutes left, but and we are, what we don't hear today, we are going to try to hear on Friday. So we are coming back on Friday this week. I hope everybody's aware of that. And the other people who have bills today are members of our committee. Let's see. Representative Moran, I don't I assume this is going to take longer than 5 minutes. But. Okay, would you mind if we wait? If we wait on this? And come. Do you have anything? Is there anybody here who's not usually hanging around this place, who's not a lobbyist or working for an agency, who's here to testify on one of our remaining bills? And which bill is that, ma'am?
The bill about the Human Services Bill, 820.
820. Okay. All right.
The section is 256B.
Okay. Are you able to come back on Friday?
I am not. But
okay, because we're not going to get through. All right. Well, what we'll do is then we'll take up Representative Loeffler's bill, 820, and then we'll get to your testimony, and then we will just. Representative Loeffler, we won't move your bill. We'll just start to discuss it. We'll take testimony from this witness, and then we, if it's okay with you, we'll pick it up on Friday, and then we'll move the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And House Bill 820 is the Department of Human Services bill, and like the bills that we've been hearing before, is a mix of correcting erroneous drafting and some minor changes. I'll just briefly say that it allows, the first section allows electronic communications versus having to mail things by first class mail when we've gotten routinely to doing that with notifying providers. The next section allows MA to be earned by DHS when they do certain actions related to reviews of medical necessity. Three corrects a drafting error so that people can be notified in advance of their end date to help people renew their eligibility. And then the next sections deal with changing from prior authorization to retrospective review and seeking of outliers, which should streamline the process for a variety of providers. That's the area I think we now have a testifier on. And I'd like for the committee's understanding that to have Scott Leitz from the Department of Human Services just to give a little more background.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Leitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Scott Leitz with the Department of Human Services. Sections 4 through Section through the rest of the bill, Section 7. What this does, we currently, state law requires us to do prior authorization of services for certain types of providers. And we've been working closely with the physical therapists, the occupational therapists, the speech-language pathologists, and audiologists. What we've discovered in looking at information is that the vast majority of the services that are delivered by these providers, they have to seek prior authorization for them, but the vast majority of the time, it's approved. And so in order to streamline and make the process simpler for those providers who are providing important services to our clients, as well as to streamline on the administrative side, we're moving, what this bill would do would strike the requirement for prior authorization for services and rather would allow the department to move to a retrospective review of services to really look for outliers. As I said, the vast majority of the services here are approved and are within the reasonable guidelines. There are some outliers, and I think the way that this would do it would be moving us from that rather cumbersome prior authorization process to a more a retrospective look to see where there were outliers and then working with those providers at that point.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Leitz.
Madam Chair, I think it's important to note Section 7, which requires the commissioner to publish in its manual and on the website the criteria by which they would be reviewing things. So, I mean, it's not just walking into a black box, I don't believe.
All right. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And so I'd like to get our testifier up that can't come back. Representative Loeffler, if that's okay, I'd like to get the testifier who can't return, and we'll get her testimony, and then when we come back on Friday, we can pick it up again. Thank you. Thank you, members, for your patience. Welcome to the committee.
Please thank you, Chair Liebling. Thank you also for allowing me to do this today, and also members of the committee. My name is Kathy Brennan, and I am here to speak for the Minnesota Occupational Therapy Association in support of this change. Prior authorization of all occupational therapy, physical therapy, and speech-language pathology has been a topic of discussion with us, with the Department of Human Services, who we meet with monthly, for the last 2 years because of all the problems that we've had in this authorization system. Problems including the inability of DHS and the contracted review entity computers to interact with one another, causing manual reviews to have to happen and affecting certainly the access of our clients who have to wait for the prior authorization for long periods of time. There were also concerns from our group of therapists that the reviewers did not have the skills to knowledgeably review rehab services, certainly a concern to all of us. We appreciate that our voices were heard by DHS. They have hired a new contracted review entity to start in April 2013. We are now engaged, as Mr. Light said, in developing a new review system. They are including us in talking about what would work best. The main concern being, of course, access to therapy and no delay. So we support this bill to eliminate prior authorization on all records for occupational therapy and the development of a new system that will be much more good for all of us. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Abel.
Just a comment. I won't be here on Friday, but this whole this system has been a mess and an embarrassment, and thank goodness they're fixing it. So this is the right way to go.
All right. Thanks, Representative Abler. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, so members, we're going to take up 820 on Friday. So if you can, just put the papers back in your file, thereby saving a few trees maybe. And we are adjourned.